The Gambling Files podcast presents Desert Island Discs with your host, John Bruford. Hello and welcome to TGF Presents Desert Island Discs for legal purposes. And we've taken no legal advice on this, so you know we're good. We are obliged to explain that our guests are not on a desert island. I don't know why. I don't think there's any radio shows that we're treading on the toes of. Anyway, Desert Island Discs. I'm your host, John Bruford. This is an offshoot of the Gambling Files podcast, where we invite luminaries and occasionally trailer trash from the gambling industry to come on and talk about the sort of the landmark things in their life in the context of them being stranded on a tropical island. That's right, lawyers, tropical. And they get to choose things that they can to keep them sane. So they get to choose three albums, three books, three movies, one song not on the albums, one pet from any time in their life, one object, one dessert, hence the name of the podcast, and two pieces of advice, one from their younger self to their older self, one from their older self to their younger self. And they can choose if they want to when they receive the advice. So I am very pleased to say that our guest on this episode is none other than Gary Green. Gary was a guest on the Gambling Files podcast probably about a year ago, I think. And is involved in some very interesting things in Northern Nevada. Gary, welcome. I can't say welcome back. It's a slightly different podcast, but I am the same person and I am in the same room. Welcome.
What the fuck? I thought there was an island here. I thought I got a free trip to an island to do this podcast. Where's my island?
Yeah, you're shit at. That's how we get people on. That's how we lure them in.
I get it. You're a sneaky bastard. Okay, all right. All right.
It's like that buy a Nintendo for $100 deal that you see in the window and there's a little asterisk in the corner and you get the Nintendo for $100 if you spend $600 on other shit that you don't need.
You are the Timu of podcast. I get it.
That's frighteningly accurate. It's not just my head that has a shine. Do you see what I did there with shine?
Shine. I guess I saw what you did there.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So, Gary, if I were to introduce you with a title, what would your job title be?
You know, I'm
raconteur.
I'm going to a trade show next week, and I had that problem because you have to list under your name your title. And so I just put bon vivant under my name. And
that's nice.
Let them deal with that.
I would have gone for bon vivant as maybe my third guest. Raconteur would have been first.
I like that. I like that.
Yeah. And you wear it so well.
I think. Thank you.
I had a trade show thing, and I think I put God of Content on mine.
Oh, I like it.
Well, you know, people are too modest.
Indeed.
Except me. Gary, you are stranded on a tropical island.
Yes.
And I guess are forewarned about what we're going to ask them because people do like to give this a bit of thought. So, and I thought you'd be a really interesting person to do this. But as if people listening haven't heard Gary's Gambling Files episode, Gary was a professional musician and I believe still is very passionate about music and is still involved in music in the folk scene in America. And you told a phenomenal story that I'm not even going to hint at about helping a young man find his way. And that was really lovely. I'm not going to mention that because it might come up later.
Sure.
So, Gary, should we start with your three albums?
Sure.
Okay, what's your first one?
I think probably my favorite album that I would take along would be Johnny Cash Live at Folsom Prison. And there's just so many different types of songs Cash does on that. But also, that album has on it the song Folsom Prison, which I believe outside, and this sounds so ridiculous, I know, but outside of maybe Shelley's Queen Mab, it has the best poetic line in the English language, as far as I'm concerned. And that is, I shot a man in Reno just to watch him die. I mean, what a line. And so that's the first album I would have. I would have Live at Folsom Prison with Johnny Cash.
That's a stunning choice. It's a phenomenal album. And I believe listeners in the UK, I think the single of A Boy Named Sue came from that album.
It actually, I know too much about Johnny Cash because I knew him. Boy Named Sue actually came from the Live at San Quentin album. So,
oh, yeah, which, different prison.
Which was the different prison, same concept.
So I was having a conversation with my daughter in the car the other day. And she was like, do you like country music, Dad? And I'm like, no, I fucking don't. And then I said, but except for one artist, I said, that's Laura Cantrell. And she said, all right, okay. And she thought about it and she came back. She said, but what about Johnny Cash? I'm like, well, Johnny Cash is different. It's like,
you know, I've argued forever that Johnny Cash is not country. Johnny Cash is some other genre out there. I mean, you know, recently the music industry has created this genre they call Americana, and he fits nicely into that. But, you know, Johnny Cash is somewhere between folk and the Outer Limits, you know, somewhere from space. He's Johnny Cash.
Yeah, there's so many influences that he wears on his sleeve, and very proudly.
Indeed.
Because a lot of musicians from his era didn't.
Right.
Didn't acknowledge their predecessors or anything like that. But you can see every influence, and he doesn't shy away from any of them.
Exactly.
Did you see? I went to see the Elvis Presley in concert movie the other day. Have you seen it?
I have not seen it yet. It's actually on my checkoff list of things to do. I have not yet seen it.
I am not an Elvis fan, and I loved it.
Wow.
I came out of it just absolutely buzzing, but with a huge respect for the man as a musician, which I had not had before.
Interesting.
And his band, dear fuck, they can play. But not just can they play, they obviously adored him.
True.
There's a lovely to and fro and respect there. But it dawned on me watching these live performances how little I know about the rest of his enormous catalogue. But he's another artist who always recognised where his music came from, where it evolved from.
That's very true.
And I didn't appreciate that until I saw the movie. But see the movie, it's really beautiful.
I will.
It's very cool. Good.
Other albums. Anyway,
sorry.
No,
yeah,
bring
me number two.
Okay, so a complete change from Folsom Prison. Creedence Clearwater's Green River album. That's the album that has Bad Moon Rising on it. I would have that with me because from my teen years, that was an influential, always listened to, especially when I was stoned, my go-to album in those years. And so you know, it's sort of a ride down memory lane. And I recently saw John Fogerty, who was the creator of Creedence Clearwater. I recently saw him in concert in Vegas. And, you know, the guy's almost 80 years old. In fact, he may be 80. And he's still rocking like it's 1968. You know, he still sounds the same.
Well, they had so many issues with the band and with the name and with the rights and all of that stuff that he probably had a bit of time off. So he's probably just he's banked that.
Really? And he controls his songs again. He finally won that stupid lawsuit that lasted like 30 years. He finally won it like 2 years ago.
But so many artists from that period did similar things.
Right.
I always liken it to football in the UK. You know, you have these pictures of stadiums from, you know, the early 1900s, and there's 120,000 people in there, and the players are earning less than a Coleman or a drayman or any really basic physical labor. The players aren't getting any of that. I think my car alarm's just going off, so that's good. Yeah, it is. Hold on, one sec. Sorry. Sorry about that, Gary, if we got a bit of backing me up, for fuck's sake. Right, somebody at the door. Don't move. Fuck me.
Thank you. Oh, it's very sensitive. Thank you.
There will be no more interruptions.
In 1976, when I recorded my first album, in the midst of one of the songs, this jet flies over, and it's like so loud and so low, it's shaking the walls, even inside the padded studio. And it's wow in the middle of my song. So I'm like, oh, fuck, ruined that. And the owner of the record company was there, and he said, no, leave it in there. It's real. It makes you sound authentic. Okay, then. So, you know, this was authentic. Leave the roof, 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 and the guy at the door.
Maybe.
Or maybe not.
Friend of mine recorded an album in her living room using a Mac laptop. And it's a phenomenal album. It's a real thing of beauty. And I'm not saying that because she's my friend. She's just a unique musician. And she finished the album, and her chap was a musician, her husband at the time. And he did the production. He sort of mastered it, I suppose. And so she was able to shop a finished album around record companies. And that's how that got published. But she maintains to this day that you can hear traffic in the background of some songs. And like, I've listened to it with headphones on. I've listened to it loud. I've listened to it. I don't hear any of that. But I guess as a recording artist, you'll always hear the things that piss you off when you're recording.
You know, it's like I know a lot of people that are in television industry, and a lot of them will not watch the TV shows that they're in because they see so many flaws with themselves. You know, they'll look at the screen and go, oh, my God, look at that pimple I have there. I can't believe I didn't put makeup on that. It's self-criticism.
I'd just be worried that I'd look at myself and go, Jesus, I'm good. What's your third album? Credence is, it's for an American and an American musician. It's a seminal choice. So
of course.
Wow me with your third.
The third one is going to be Pete Seeger's Rainbow Race album. It's not a real well-known album. It was Pete Seeger's last album on Columbia Records. And it's, it's got a full roundup of everything that is Pete Seeger. It is folky. It is historical. It is hysterical. It is political. It's got all of the pieces of Pete Seeger in it. And you know, my recording career was as a topical musician. You know, I wrote political folk songs. And Pete was not only a close friend, but he was a huge influence on my writing. And so my third piece would be that particular album, Rainbow Race, from Pete Seeger. Because it is, you know, if you have always heard of Pete Seeger and you don't know which one of like 80 albums the guy has you want to listen to, Rainbow Race is the one because it's all in that. Everything is on that album. So I like that one too.
Is there a standout song in that for you? I remember as soon as you said his name, I remembered he was a contemporary of yours.
The standout song in there today, unfortunately, would not. If you'd asked me this 5 years ago, it would have been a throwaway song. Unfortunately, today, there is a big standout song in there. There's a song called Last Train to Nuremberg. And I don't even need to finish being American in this political climate. You get it. And I've got to tell you, when Pete wrote that song in the late 60s, early 70s, I'm sure he had no idea that in the 21st century we'd be listening to it going, damn, you nailed it. But Last Train to Nuremberg, man. If nothing else, even if you don't get that album, go to Spotify or YouTube or somewhere and listen to Last Train to Nuremberg by Pete Seeger, and then join me in saying, damn.
Interestingly, as a Brit, Obviously, when you say Nuremberg, most people will think of one particular thing. But Nuremberg has a dual connotation in the UK, and it comes from the tradition of rhyming slang, which is associated with Cockneys, people born within the sound of the Bow Bells in East London. But it's sort of, it's spread out and it's mutated, and rhyming slang is kind of everywhere, and it's very popularly used in everyday speech. And Nuremberg, you might say,
ooh, ugly.
We're keeping it real.
Yeah. Okay, got it.
With a Nuremberg, you might say, oh, I'm in Nuremberg's. Nuremberg trials, piles.
Oh, goodness. Okay.
Oh, okay. True story.
Learn something new every day.
I like people to leave this podcast thinking, I did not know that, or I wish I didn't know that.
I wish I didn't know that. You know, I'm going to be in London in about the same time you're in Vegas. I'm going to be in London. I'm going to be in London in May. And I'll try to have forgotten that by the time I get to London. Probably good street advice.
Or if you hear somebody mention the Nuremberg's, just give them an appreciative wince.
Indeed.
It could happen. It could happen. We've got your albums, and I'm going to say, and this isn't a diss, I'm not surprised by any of your choices there.
Cool.
I wouldn't have guessed them, but when you said them, I'm like, yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, figures with me. Yeah.
The era, the, you know.
Right.
Yeah, right. I can totally see that. So shall we go into, let's do books.
Books. Okay, now this is a strange mixture. And this is in no particular order. But as far as a fiction book, there is a little known, if not unknown, book by Mario Puzo. Mario Puzo wrote The Godfather.
He did.
He has a book called Fools Die. And it's a long book. You know, it's probably 350, 400 page book. But it's really a good look into the psychology of gamblers and the people who run casinos. And Puzo was a degenerate gambler in his secret identity. I mean, apparently they say he pissed away all of his godfather money in Vegas, which you have to admire in one sense. At any rate, the book Fools Die is about a degenerate gambler and about a guy that runs a casino as a manager and about the mob guy that actually owns the casino. And it's a really, he does a great job of getting into the heads of those people. And it's almost like a reference book. I mean, you can go through and go, hey, I know that dude. Yeah, he's over at the Wynn now. I mean, it's.
I hope you can't do that.
Really. But Fools Die is one of them. The second book that I would have with me, just for survival purposes, is a book called The Kung Fu Exercise Book. It's not like a martial arts training manual. It's really an exercise book written by a delightful woman named Sophia Delta. Sophia Delta was a Tai Chi master. I came across her in 1972 when she was in her 90s. And I read this book, and then I went looking for her, and she still was alive, living in New York. And she wrote this really good book that has a series of exercises that, I mean, look at me, I'm not like an exercise guy, you know, but these are exercises that I can do. They don't leave me going, and they're really good for your health. And so I think that if I was going to be on this non-existent island out there that I was hoping I would be on today, I would want to have that exercise book with me just to keep me centered, to keep me sane, and to keep me alive. So that would be choice number two. And then
that's a really interesting choice.
It's the exercise routine. I mean, really, there's nothing difficult in it. It's things like, you know, rolling your head. Like, that's one of the exercises in it. I mean, it's good stuff, man. So
things that we don't do in the day-to-day. Doing the same to your ankles is also really very useful.
This is very true. This is very true.
You've reminded me, I read a terrific book by an American writer called Matthew Polly, I think his name is. And it's called, I think it's called American Shaolin. And he describes himself as a 90-pound weakling at university in America, not enjoying his studies. He's studying Mandarin, I think, amongst other things, but he's good at languages. And he thinks, fuck this, and decides to leave college and go and live with Shaolin monks in China.
Very cool.
But it's not the usual fish out of water nonsense. It's none of that because he can speak the language. And so he speaks to people and he learns and he integrates and he trains properly. But it goes into the history of why Kung Fu was developed. And I thought this was really interesting, that it was developed because the monks were trying to teach the next generation how to do monk stuff. I was going to say how to be monkey, but it's a very different set of movements.
Well, it depends on your perspective, but go ahead.
Well, there is drunken monkey kung fu, of course. They devised this series of movements so that their young students could do them in the morning and get rid of all of their excess energy. And in the afternoon, they would come and learn the theological stuff and they would be totally receptive mentally.
Interesting.
And that's where Kung Fu comes from. That's awesome, I think.
Very cool.
But this is Gary Green's podcast. It's not John Bruford's
podcast.
That's
okay. It's a fun podcast.
So but book number two is a practical choice, which is surprising, but okay.
So
bring it.
So since we had practical and we had fiction, now we'll get ridiculous. The third book I would have, if I could only have three books, would be Capital, Karl Marx's Das Kapital, Volume 1. And I would have that because it is so packed full of that era German philosophy that it is overwhelming to one's brain, and it forces one to wade through it and make one's brain work. Either that or tear the thing up and throw it off the island and never see it again. But in my case, it's a good intellectual, or lack thereof, intellectual exercise. And so I would have that there, not to study all the time, but to use as intellectual gymnastics, if you will, sort of the Kung Fu exercise book for the brain.
That's a very surprising choice. Again, it's made my brain go off on a slight tangent. There is a very famous British comic called Viz. It's a comic for adults. It's sort of satire and buffoonery. I've been reading it since I was about 14. I still subscribe to it to this day. And Viz, in a moment of utter genius, the publishers decided to compile a swearing dictionary.
Oh, excellent.
It's called the Profanisaurus.
Of course it is.
And one of the larger editions of the Profanisaurus is called Das Kapital.
Excellent. Excellent.
If I ever see you in the flesh, I'll bring you a copy of the Profanisaurus, Gary, because it might replace Das Kapital on your island.
It could well do so.
I think it would be one of my island choices. That's that's a crazy trio of books, but great, brilliant. That's what it's all about.
Cool.
Now we go on to movies.
You know, I tried to rank movies in order. You know, here's my best, here's my second, here's my third. And I can't do that. I've got 1, 2, 3, and they're all on the same level to me, and they're all different. You know, Tom Hanks, the actor Tom Hanks, says in some film, he's talking about the movie The Godfather, and he says, you know, in that one film, The Godfather, the entire sum of Western knowledge is contained in that one film. And I mean, he did it as a throwaway comic line, but I sort of like that idea. And so one of my films that I would have with me would be The Godfather, the original Godfather, not part two, part three. And, you know, I think it's extremely well written. It's well acted. And the sum of all Western knowledge is contained in that film. So
there are so many good stories about The Godfather. It's got my favorite all-time actor in it. It's got James Caan, and I love James Caan.
Jimmy Caan was great.
But also, I don't know if you've read his, might have read his autobiography. Do you know the work of Robert Evans, who produced it?
Yes, yes.
Evans' autobiography, The Kid Stays in the Picture, is a phenomenal read. I mean, it's one of the all-time great Hollywood books. And I'm one of those people, I don't think there are many great Hollywood books. But Evans has such a unique perspective, and he's such a cheeky fucker. And he talks about Coppola turning up with a 90-minute cut of The Godfather and him saying, "This is not what you pitched to me. Go away and make it longer." But the thing that The Godfather really changed, and I don't think people appreciate this, like everybody's like, "Oh, Jaws created the modern blockbuster." Kind of. But The Godfather made it possible, because The Godfather was the first major studio movie in the US to have a nationwide launch.
Really?
Because they would open out regionally, because the cost of film was so great.
Of course.
You know, because you're looking at, oh, God knows how many thousands of cinemas across the US back then. Yeah. Absolutely shitloads. And it's a huge upfront cost for the studio, and it's a complete what if it doesn't do very well. And of course, when Evans did that with The Godfather, that was the marketing, that was the only marketing story the movie needed.
Right.
It's like, this film is so good, you can all see it at the same time. Instead of, because it could take 8-9 months for a movie to get to where you were, because it'll start in California, it'll start in New York. If it's big, it might start in Four Corners and then move towards the middle. But it was, yeah, Godfather changed all that.
I never thought of that, but you're right. I mean, you know, growing up in Appalachia, in the rural South, I mean, you know, we would see on television this film, this big movie out there, and 18 months later, the thing would show up in bumfuck Tennessee. I mean, for that very reason. Interesting.
Yeah. Robert Evans, I mean, for all of his flaws, that dude had vision.
Wow. Wow.
And yeah, he's a big part of why that. Also, here's a thing I was reading the other day, right? And I already knew this, but I was reminded of it the other day. John Cazale. What a talent. What, he's one of those wonderful actors that I sort of describe as the proper furniture actor.
Okay.
He makes every scene he's in more real. But he made 5 movies before he died, and all 5 movies were Best Picture nominees.
Wow. Wow.
Now, that's never going to be repeated.
Right. I knew, of course, Godfather. I knew Dog Day Afternoon, but I wasn't aware of it. But his other films were awesome. Wow.
So he did The Conversation, right. He did The Deer Hunter, and... Right.
Wow.
Are we missing a movie? Godfather 2.
Oh, yeah.
All Best Picture nominees.
Yeah.
That moment where you can't remember that one film, you're like, fuck, I can't Google live. Okay, Godfather, amazing choice, it's a wonderful journey of a film, so I can totally see that one. What's next?
Casablanca. I mean,
okay.
Casablanca is the movie. It's the movie. I mean, you know, it's got all the elements. It's all there. It also has, they do a really good job with building drama in it. You know, that scene where the Nazis are sitting around the piano and they're singing Diefenhof or some, you know, a Horst Wessel song or something, and all of a sudden, everyone else in the bar is singing La Marseillaise, and it's like, oh my God, what drama, what power, and you know, besides that kind of drama and that kind of build to it, there's funny stuff in it too. I mean, all the routines with Sam, the piano player, are really funny, and you know, Bogart. I mean, Bogart. This is the classic Bogart's Bogart. I mean, everybody wants to be able to say, what nationality are you? Me? I'm a drunkard. I mean, you know, you just gotta love Bogart. So I think it's a great film.
It's an interesting film, and it's the movie that I often think of when I think of William Goldman's memoir, the first one, Adventures in the Screen Trade. And he opens the book by saying, nobody in the movies knows anything. Because Casablanca was essentially a B movie with a bunch of people in it that nobody gave two fucks about.
Right, right.
They were has-beens or never-was. And, like, you know, I look back and I think, okay, you got Bogart, you got Claude Rains, who had an amazing career, but was on the way down.
Right.
Peter Lorre, who will forever have a place in my heart for all sorts of great movies and difficult parts. And people forget that there is a whole little stereotype built on Peter Lorre. Like the little bug-eyed dude that pops up in cartoons of all different types, that's Peter Lorre.
That's Peter Lorre. You're right. You're right.
But yeah, it was a bunch of actors that nobody cared about making a movie that was a B picture that became something quite different because it was really, really good.
It really was. And the timing was great too. I mean, it came out during the war. So, I mean, it was good timing.
Timing is very often the thing with movies. And in fact, I just made a little pun there without even realizing it. Great example of that is John Carpenter's The Thing, you know, way ahead of its time.
Indeed.
If it had been released in just 10 years later, I think we'd all just be regarding it as an all-time, well, we do regard it as an all-time great now, but I think it would have been hugely successful and regarded as an all-time great.
Right.
What's your third movie, Gary?
Tombstone. You know, I was raised, you know, being raised in the U.S. in the black and white television era, the great moral passion plays that we were taught were Westerns. Every night, all the TV shows were Westerns. Saturday, all the TV shows were either cartoons or Westerns. So I grew up with that Western mentality. And then the film Tombstone came along, and it is so gritty, real. You know, of all of those supposedly historical dramas, it's the first one where the actors were the actual ages of the people they were playing, and they used dialogue that was actually the dialogue from that era. And you look at the film and you don't say, oh, that's a great film about the 1780s. Look at that 1956 beehive haircut that woman has. I mean, no, this film was realistic, well done, brilliantly acted. And I mean, I think it's Val Kilmer's best role. I mean, I really do.
There's a very good argument for that.
His Doc Holliday is just incredible. And I think it's
a great story that's been told many times. I can't think of a bad iteration. I can't think of a bad telling of the story. Now, nearly every movie is at least very good.
I think that's
But
true.
Tombstone does stand out because it's got a stunning cast. It's even got, if I remember correctly, the great Bill Paxton is in it.
Indeed, indeed. And he plays Wyatt Earp's
big
brother,
favorite.
Right?
Big favorite of mine. In fact, if I see his name on a film, I'll watch it regardless of how shit it is.
So get this, Sylvester Stallone's brother, Frank, is in that film. Doc Holliday kills him in one of the opening scenes with Doc Holliday. Doc Holliday sticks a knife in him. And
interesting.
Yeah, the cast is just, you look at that cast and go, holy crap, look at all these people.
Yeah, and this isn't a diss of Kurt Russell, but he's obviously not in the real instance, but the character in the movies is, it's almost like the fulcrum that everything else works off. But he doesn't have to do that much. Do you know what I mean? And I'm not saying that Kurt Russell's a limited actor. He's really not. He's a very talented dude. It's just that it's one of the least demanding things I think he's done. It's one of the best movies he's been in.
I think it's by design, because that script, I've got somewhere on my computer, I've got various iterations of that script leading up to the final. And the script that we see on screen, Kurt Russell actually rewrote himself. He rewrote major portions of that and took over part of the directing of that also. And I think his downplaying of himself is probably by design. I really think so. Because if you look, especially at some of those scenes where he interacts with Kilmer and even with his brothers, you know, it's clear that he's highlighting them. It's clear that he is yielding, if you will, to them without giving up the authority of the character. So I appreciate that in him.
Well, it's a film with a lot of great furniture actors.
Indeed.
What these days they call character actors, what they used to just call actors.
Right. Right.
People who will just be in a scene and they will enhance that scene by staying in character and being their character and just getting on with that shit.
And there's some scary guys. Powers Booth's performance in that, you know, that guy is an evil mother. I mean, you're glad they finally shoot him. Holy cow.
Powers Booth always did evil well.
He did, didn't he?
There's a movie that Paxton directed, I think, three movies before he died. And the first one was a movie called Frailty. I don't know if you're aware of it.
I don't know that one.
But it's him and Matthew McConaughey. And I'm pretty sure it's Powers Booth. Powers Booth's from Texas, isn't he?
Probably. I don't think that could be a fake accent.
It's the third Texan. I'm pretty sure it's Powers Booth.
Probably so.
McConaughey and Booth share the screen, but Paxton doesn't share the screen with any of them. And it's about a guy who decides he's been chosen by God to do righteous work and get rid of nasty, awful people who are hiding in plain sight on the earth. And it's a stunningly good film because it's actually told from his son's perspective.
Uh-huh.
And it's really powerful and the kids are incredibly good. But actually, Booth, McConaughey, you know, they're in this like tight little room while this story's being recounted. And it's like these guys, there's a tradition in the UK of theatre actors. And these guys are the ultimate furniture actors. You know, people like Bernard Hill, who was the king of men in Lord of the Rings and the captain of the ship in Titanic. People like him. I once saw Bernard Hill walking down the street in Norwich city centre and nobody recognised him.
Wow.
And this guy had been in the two biggest films of the last 30 years and he was just walking down the street. That's furniture. You know what I mean? That's
indeed.
Powers
Booth also was Jim Jones. In a I don't know if that played in the UK or not, just television miniseries here. It was like 8 episodes. And he plays Jim Jones, you know, the nutso preacher that
Kool-Aid. Yeah, he's an evil bastard.
Yeah. And he's, again, as you said, he was really good at playing evil bastards.
He is, because he's an actor. He never goes over the top. He's, what I was coming to there is Powers Booth is like a theatre actor. He does small movements. He does understated. And he kind of builds things. And he's really low key, but all the better for it. And I can totally see him as Jim Jones. That, as far as I know, has never played in the UK because Jim Jones is not a well-known name over here. People are familiar with the "don't drink the Kool-Aid"
right,
line.
Of course.
But we also don't have Kool-Aid over here, so I don't know how that one caught on.
You were lucky.
One song not on the albums.
Sounds of Silence, Simon and Garfunkel.
Wow.
You know, I like the music to it. It is well composed. It's not quite political, topical, but it's still political, moral. And it's one of those songs that can eat away at your brain if you just let it play over and over again. And I think it's a really good song. So, Sounds of Silence.
There was a cover by a German metal band called Disturbed a few years ago that really gave it a new lease of life and introduced it to an entirely new generation. But I think when you get a cover like that, it emphasizes what a well-written song is.
Right.
That it can be covered straight as well. They haven't fucked around with it, but they haven't made it a metal song. But covered straight, and it's still every bit as powerful as it was in, what, 1970? I don't know.
Try 1966.
Wow.
Yeah, old song.
Yeah, it was a little before my time. Only a little, though. Okay. So that category was created because I reasoned that somebody might want Eye of the Tiger by Survivor, but no fool is going to choose a Survivor album. I'm sure their albums are perfectly good, but no, I'm not.
I have to be careful on that because I know a lot of the survivors of Survivor. So, yeah, okay, I'm just going to nod on that one.
Okay, tell them I said hi.
I will, I shall. Well, actually, they'll see this.
Fuck. I'd be a marked man in Vegas in May. That's okay. It's not a diss, really, but it's, you know, let's put it this way. They were, in the UK, certainly, they're a singles band, not an album band.
That's fair.
I'll stop digging now. Now you got one pet. Pet can be from any time in your life.
I had a cat. I've had dogs and cats. I had a cat from 1972 till 1980 named Matthew. And, you know, Matthew was my pal. He hung out with me. He helped me write songs. He didn't know it, but he helped me write songs. He was a good guy. So it'd be cool to hang out with Matt again.
What kind of cat was Matthew? Was he a particular breed? Or
American short hair. Bought him at the pound, you know.
Okay. Matthew the cat. Just making notes. Did you name him?
Yes, I did.
Why'd you call a cat Matthew?
That's what he looked like. That's why I named Fetch. You know, I had a cat one time.
It's a little harsh.
Look, I had a cat one time named Fred. Because I looked at him and said, what the hell's your name? Oh, you look like Fred. Okay, you're a Fred. So, yeah.
Man, you're brutal.
I've got two cats right now, a male and female, from the same litter, and they're named Nick and Nora. Put on your movie hat for a minute. That would be Nick and Nora's Charles.
Infinite Playlist.
Nick and Nora Charles from Thin Man.
Okay.
So, yep. Anyway, so Matthew.
Matthew. Matthew the cat.
Cool.
Safe journey, Matthew the cat.
Indeed.
So, one object.
That one was easy. A guitar.
Yeah,
I mean, you know, I'm a musician, yeah. And hauling a piano around is a pain in the ass. So, guitar.
Yeah, but it'll wash up. You won't have to drag it far.
Oh, this is true.
But also, I would think the salty air is probably going to play havoc with the piano.
It will with the guitar too, but what the hell? It's, you know.
Yeah, but you might end up with some really good, interesting sounds too.
Yeah, you know. And I'm not that good of a guitar player anyway, so who the hell's going to notice? So
you're better than me. Right, to be fair, I've never tried.
So there you go.
Okay, are we talking, would you have an acoustic guitar or would you have...
No, acoustic guitar. I'm a fan.
How many strings would your acoustic have?
Until I broke them, 6.
Oh, you could have extra strings.
I could take extra strings. I'd still have 6. Just a standard 6-string acoustic guitar.
Well, just to keep with the Canadian tradition, we will buy you one at the Five and Dime.
You know, the first guitar I learned to play on was a $12 guitar. And what we call the action, the distance between the neck of the guitar and the strings, it was so far removed that you could probably pitch a tent between the strings and the neck. I mean, it built calluses on your fingertips really quickly. It was like the cheapest, worst guitar ever. And that's what I learned to play on. So no matter what we get at the Five and Dime, it can't be any worse than that $12 Stella that I learned to play on.
Yeah, but I bet you every guitar you played after that you really appreciated.
Well, hell yeah. Absolutely. Yes.
That's it. Like, my first bike was a stainless steel frame and it weighed almost as much as me. And that's saying something because I was really fucking fat at the time. Every bike I've ridden since then has had at least an aluminium frame and maybe some carbon in it. And it's like, wow.
Yeah.
This feels like it was handmade by the baby Jesus.
Gotta love it. Gotta love it.
It's like, yeah, when you learn on real shit, it's... Life is sweet.
Indeed.
So now you've got to choose a dessert, Gary.
I'm a chocolate-holic, But my favorite dessert is German chocolate cake, which incidentally has nothing to do with Germany or Deutschland. This particular blend of chocolate was created in Chicago, Illinois, in the U.S., by a guy named German, and he marketed it as German chocolate. But German chocolate cake, you know, with the coconut and that particular mixture of chocolate. And I love German chocolate cake. It's hard to find, but it's one of my favorite desserts, probably my favorite dessert.
I have never tried it.
It's when you're in Vegas, you'll be able to find it. Somebody will have it in Vegas. So see, find it somewhere in Vegas.
Well, I'm supposed to be off the sugar, so maybe I'll find it and just look at it.
Just snort it. Just.
Yeah, there's no sugar involved that way.
Give me a line of German chocolate here.
Your lungs just aren't designed for inhaling sugar, so I'd probably be safe.
Yeah, there you go.
I mean, after the pneumonia is gone. Now we're on to the nitty gritty. You got two pieces of advice, younger to older, older to younger. Whichever you want to start with, it's all yours.
My younger, from when I was around 18 to 21-ish, to me today, in my 70s, I actually wrote as part of the liner notes of my first album, so I'm cheating a little bit, but it was good advice to me for all times. And that is, I wrote, "Don't let making a living ever get in the way of living." And it's a piece of advice that I have not adhered to consistently through my life, and I should have. And I think it's a piece of advice that is good, not just for me, but should be for everyone. Don't let making a living get in the way of the living.
Unfortunately, particularly right now in the world, people are working two jobs, three jobs in some instances, to just stay where they were on one job 5 years ago.
Indeed.
And it is good advice. Don't get me wrong. I'm certainly not dissing the advice. It's just harder and harder to do.
It truly is. But, you know, here's what drove it at the time. And looking back on it, I think it was sound. So many people define who they are by what job they have, you know, and to me, that is the ultimate alienation from yourself as yourself. I mean, who are you? Oh, I'm a waitress at Waffle House. That's not who you are. That's how you pay the electric bill and buy your groceries. Who are you? Don't define yourself by making a living. Making a living is what you've got to do to live, but that's not who you are. And that's the advice.
Honestly, I think most people that know me don't know what I do for a living. So yeah. I don't know whether that's good or bad. Maybe they just don't care.
Well, there's that. That's me for sure. Advice right now, looking back at the younger me, be kinder. Look, you haven't seen it, and a lot of people that know me only in recent years don't see it. But, you know, from the time I was 17, 16, until I was in my 40s, I was a mean motherfucker. I used to have what one might classify as anger issues. If we were driving down the road and you cut me off on the road, whether you did it on purpose or not, when we got to the next stoplight, very likely I'd get out of the car, walk up to your car, break out your window, pull a gun out, put it against your head, and pistol whip you. And that actually happened in my life. I have done that multiple times. I have had anger issues that, and I feel like I'm talking to a therapist, though I've never been to one. But be kinder, be nicer to people. You don't need to explode and go bonkers. And I have done that. I'm not a big guy. I'm 5'8", 5'9", And many times I would feel dissed by someone a lot larger than me, and I'd go try to kick their ass. I mean, yeah, I got beat up a lot doing that shit, but you know what? The rage would be so powerful. You know, one time I remember crossing the street when I was in graduate school. I was crossing the street, and somebody ran through a stoplight, and they're blowing their horn at me like I was doing something wrong. So when they hit their brakes, instead of like giving them a finger or something, I started pounding on the bonnet of their car, on the hood of their car, and then broke out their windshield and spit all over them. It's a wonder, honest to God, it's a wonder somebody didn't kill me. I mean, this is America. I'm surprised somebody didn't kill me. But the good news is there are things that happen in my life that I don't do that anymore. I don't have that anger anymore. I released it. And so my advice to the younger me is be kinder, chill out, be cool.
I've got to ask you this, right? You said you haven't been to a therapist. Now, I'm a big fan of therapy. But if you haven't been to a therapist, what happened to change you?
Okay, we'll do a little story here because this is what happened. I was playing guitar in Baltimore, Maryland, on stage at a coffee house. And there were two guys. This was in inner city Baltimore, which is primarily African-American black community in Baltimore City, inner city. And I'm playing in this coffee house in this black neighborhood. And there are these two white guys who had rented a room over top of the bar next door to the coffee house. And for whatever reason, they had decided they wanted to grill a steak. So they'd taken a little grill, filled it with charcoal, bought a couple of steaks, put them on the grill, went into the bar, bought a bunch of beer, brought it out. And while they're cooking their steaks there, they ran out of beer. So instead of one of them going back into the bar and the other staying there with the steaks, they both went into the bar. And when they came out, surprise, surprise, the steaks are gone. And they started screaming and yelling. And what they were screaming and yelling were, the nicest way to describe it would be, they were racial slurs about the community. They were very bad things they were saying. And they were screaming these things so loudly in this neighborhood that I'm on stage inside with the door closed, playing my guitar, and I can hear them over top of the stage monitor, over top of the PA system, and over top of my guitar and singing. And I'm getting more and more pissed off because I had this anger thing going on. So I took my guitar off and I slammed it down on the stage and I slammed the door open and I went down the steps and I said, you motherfuckers, this is the reason I left the South, is to get away from this goddamn bullshit. And I'm not going to listen to it here. And one of the guys started to take a swing at me. So I picked up his grill and I took his grill and I smashed it in with the hot coals into his face. And I figured, okay, that guy's gone. So then the other guy comes at me, and I kicked him in the solar plexus, kicked him right here, and he goes over. So I figure, okay, this is over. So I start back up the steps, and the guy that I'd burned with the grill stands up and comes after me, and I ignore him. I go up the stairs, and I close the plate glass door of the coffee house, and I'm back inside. And the guy starts screaming at me some more of this racial stuff and yelling at me. So I turned around and looked through the door of the plate glass, and I hit him just as hard as I could through that plate glass door. You'll note that I said I hit him through the plate glass door. I did not open the plate glass door. I hit him through the plate glass door. He went down with shards of glass all over him, and I was fine going through the glass. But when I pulled my hand back, not only was it bloody, but the blood, instead of just blood, it's going brump, brump in time to my heartbeat. And I turned to the barmaid in the place, and I said, give me a towel. And she threw a towel at me, and I'm trying to tie a tourniquet onto it. And the last thing I remember saying is, oh, I fucked up this time, man. When I next opened my eyes, I was laying on the bed of the Baltimore Shock Trauma Unit helicopter. and I'm looking up into the eyes of the EMT, emergency medical tech, and he turns to the helicopter pilot and says, "There's no rush. This one's lost too much blood. He's gone." And I passed out again. When I woke up, I was in surgery at Union Memorial Hospital in Baltimore in their hand clinic. And they wanted me awake because they wanted to test my nerves as they did the operation. And my hand's up like this, and there's a guy with these like microscopes on his eyes looking at it. And he's got these tools. He's the surgeon. And so I'm trying to speak, and I said, and I wanted to know how bad it was. And I said, "Doc, look, I'm a guitar player." And before I could finish the sentence, in the worst bedside manner in the history of medicine, he looks at me and smirks and says, "Not anymore, you're not." And then he continued to operate on me. Well, here's what happened. In those days, microsurgery was in its infancy. And I had sliced the carpal tunnel nerve, which runs through your wrist. And it's a bundle of nerves like this. I mean, I've only got five here to show you, but it's like hundreds of them. And I had sliced the bad boys. And unlike twisted pair telephone line, which is color-coded, and you just put the purple one back together and the yellow one back together, your nerves aren't color-coded. They don't have little serial numbers on them. So to their benefit, they were able to reconnect my nerves, and they did a fantastic job for 1980 technology. That's the good news. The bad news, they didn't connect the purple wire to the purple wire and the red wire to the red wire. So here's my right hand. You see it? So I'm hitting this finger here. Where I am feeling that is right here. No shit. If I thump my hand like that, I feel it right over here. And I don't know if you can see on the podcast, but I've got this lovely scar right here on my wrist. And I've got another lovely scar here on the back of my hand. And that's why he said I would never play guitar again. I went into a really funky depression because I defined myself, you know, never making a living, get in the way of living. I defined myself as a folk singer playing guitar. And I could not play anymore. My mother, who was a music teacher, tried to help me. There was a very famous Brit musician in the 17th century whose name escapes me right now, but he only had one hand. And he wrote a number of really long piano pieces for left-handed only. So she bought me all of those books and sat down and drilled me on playing piano with my left hand, which was, yeah, right, exactly. I mean, it was very cool of her. I get it, and it was empathetic and all that, but that's not what I needed. I don't want to, no. So eventually I started trying to play a little with my right hand. Actually, she scolded me and was yelling at me, "Bullshit, play with your hand, play it. And so I played a little bit with my right hand. And then finally, after 4 or 5 years, I picked up guitar again. And, you know, if there's good news of it, it was my right hand, which is what I strum with and use my thumb with and finger pick with. It was not my left hand, which is what I do my fretting and playing with. So I still had that. But besides the physical damage that it did to me, it was just like, "Boy, was that a dumbass thing to do, Garrett? All because you were pissed off at him? There would have been better ways to deal with that, you dumb fuck." And that did it. I mean, do I still get angry at stuff? Of course, there's lots of shit that makes me mad. But do I go bonkers and start beating the shit out of people or hurting myself or hurting other people or threatening people? Why? I mean, so that was the event.
I love the sound of your mum.
Yeah.
Love that. That's pretty special.
Yeah.
So listen, you dropped a sentence early on in this recording, and I've got to go back to it. You knew Johnny Cash.
I knew you were going to come back to that. And I'll tell you why I knew you were going to come back to it. I was sitting in Vegas one day with a guy who's a security expert for casinos. And we were talking about something with casino security systems. And I said some Garyism off the cuff. And he said, you know, I had dinner last week with some people, and Muhammad Ali said the same thing to me. And he kept talking. I'm like, whoa, whoa, whoa. Rewind here. Muhammad Ali said that to you? And he said, oh, yeah, I thought you knew. I'm married to Joe Lewis's daughter. So, I'm like, fuck me. Okay, then.
Yeah, just drop another one in there.
Yeah, so, wow, okay, all right. So, as soon as I rolled off that I knew JR, that I knew Cash, I knew you were going to do that. So here's the thing. You know, my formative years, as they say, ages 12 to 16, were in Nashville. And at that time, Nashville was a very tightly knit, one industry town. It wasn't even a big city. I mean, there weren't a million people there. It was a small town, and the one industry in town was the music business. And everybody in one way or another knew somebody or was part of either the music industry or the support network for the music industry. I mean, my mother was a piano teacher and taught the children of stars of the Grand Ole Opry. You know, that was the community. So I, like all kids of the era in Nashville, wanted to be a songwriter. And so I wanted to pitch songs, and so at 15 years old, I started pitching songs, and, you know, you pitch them to everybody. I knew a bunch of people from the Opry, either through my mother or from hanging out there, but I also was really a Johnny Cash fan even then. So I recorded a little reel-to-reel tape, and I mailed it to Johnny Cash, which wasn't far from where we lived. He lived out in Hendersonville, and much to my surprise, rather than getting the standard form letter back, I got a telephone call from his sister, Reba Hancock, who managed his publishing, and said that JR, which is what the family called him, really, really liked him, really liked the song. And how old am I? And I told her, and she said, I could tell she was smiling on the phone. And she asked me if I would like to meet her brother. And so, let me think. Do I want to meet Johnny Cash? Gee, yeah. So she invited me out to his house. He held a couple of times a month what he called guitar pulls. And this was, everybody would sit around the den on the lower level of their house out at the lake. And they would have a guitar, and they would pass it around the room to everybody in the room, and everybody would do a song they had written. And I was invited to that guitar pull. And let me tell you, the people that are at this thing, like the one I went to, Kris Kristofferson was there. I mean, like, oh, my God. And I'm a 15-year-old kid sitting there, and I'm sitting on the floor. So the guitar comes to me. I didn't play guitar. I hadn't got that $12 guitar yet. I played piano. My mother's a piano teacher. They handed me a guitar. I don't know what the hell to do with this guitar. So very shyly and very bashfully, I just passed the guitar on to the next person. And, oh, yeah, no, bummer, man, bummer. But, you know, JR, Johnny Cash took pity on me. June Carter took pity on me. And they were extremely nice to this little 15-year-old kid. And over the years, you know, I saw them many, many times over the years. When I was a freshman in college, not that many years after that, when I was a freshman in college, I was looking for something to do, as one does when one is a freshman in college. And off in the distance from the campus at the University of Tennessee, I saw these giant arc spotlights. And those spotlights either meant that there was a movie premiere, which I knew was unlikely in Knoxville, Tennessee, or there was a state fair going on or some big to-do. So I decided to follow the spotlights and see what the to-do was. What the to-do was the 1972 Chevrolets were being introduced by the local Chevrolet dealership. And as part of that introduction, he had a big flatbed trailer from a truck there and microphones and amplifiers on it. Well, for somebody raised in rural South, what that meant was there was going to be a country music concert of some kind as part of his sales pitch here. and somebody was going to be playing there. So I said, well, I'll hang out and see who it is. So after a few minutes, this big long limousine pulls up, and out of the limousine gets Mother Maybelle Carter, who was Johnny Cash's mother-in-law. She actually literally invented playing lead guitar. Think of every lead guitar solo you have ever heard in your life. Nobody played lead on guitar until 1928, when Mother Maybelle Carter first did it in a hotel room for RCA. So she invented lead guitar. And after the concert was over, I was pressing against the stage, and she was wondering, who's this hippie kid that's here that knows all of my songs? And we started talking, and I told her that I knew her son-in-law, and I asked her to give me guitar lessons because I was a brazen little fuck, and she did. And so I got my guitar lessons from Johnny Cash's mother-in-law, who invented lead guitar playing. And so summing all, and I was friends with her up until her death. And summing all of that up then into one short answer to your question is, yeah, I knew Johnny Cash.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Fucking hell.
It's been a fun life. What can I tell you? Rock and roll.
Some people just happen to have their eyes and ears open and end up in interesting places and situations. And I've had a great fun life. I have almost no complaints. One of my favorite books is the memoir of a guy called Edward Bunker, who, do you know the movie Reservoir Dogs?
Of course. Yes.
Okay. So he's Mr. Blue in Reservoir Dogs. And he was a career criminal, and hardcore. But he, when he was a teenager, in and out of big trouble, he was the youngest ever inmate in San Quentin. And I think youngest on the FBI's most wanted list.
Yikes.
Yeah, he was.
I like him already.
He was befriended by, oh crap, I'm not going to remember their names. This is really bad. Louise Wallace. Hal Wallace, the movie producer's wife. And Hal was one of the Golden Age producers. And Louise had, you know, time on her hands and wanted to be a good person, and took the young Bunker under her wing. And he would be going to dinner parties with, like, Truman Capote, people like that.
Wow.
Fitzgerald. You know, he met all these luminaries. And then went out dealing drugs and whoring at night and committing armed robberies and all kinds of bizarre shit. And there's a great story in the memoir. He was at, I can't remember the name of the place now, the Hearst Castle.
San Simeon.
San Simeon, thank you. How could I forget that? He was at San Simeon because Wallace was friends with Hearst's mistress. So Wallace is up there visiting her friend. He's just waiting around because he'd been driving her around. And he decides to just have a dip in the pool. This is the marble pool, the famous million-dollar pool.
Right.
He's in the pool swimming when Hearst dies in the house.
Wow.
Like, that's what your story about Johnny Cash's mother-in-law just rang bells with me reading about Bunker. Read any book by Bunker. He is one of the best writers I have ever read. But his memoir is truly remarkable. And yeah, some people, they just eyes open, heart open.
I've been very fortunate. I've done a lot of different things in life because I have no attention span, but I've been very fortunate that in having no attention span, I've stumbled across some remarkable people, and I hope I've been able to sponge something from a lot of those people. Some of them were great people, like Johnny Cash or like Mother Maybelle Carter. Others were, you know from the previous podcast that I used to be vice president of Trump Hotels and Casinos, so some of them were not Johnny Cash, but you know, I've been fortunate in that I've met a lot of people.
Well, the story that I didn't mention that I thought might come up later, and I'm going to shoehorn it in here, and I know you're a busy dude, but I'm going to bring it up anyway, was the story that you told when you were running a cafe, if I remember correctly, and one of your, I think it was one of your regulars said, I'd like you to meet my son because I think he might be able to learn a few things from you. You being a musician and somebody aligned with protest music, I think, crucially. Would you share that story now? Because I really loved it. I've told my kids that story.
So incidentally, you now know a little more of it because this very coffee house where this happened to my hand is the same coffee house. I ended up owning that coffee house. And so this is this coffee house in inner city Baltimore, in this very poor African American community in Baltimore. One of our regulars visitors at the coffee house was a woman who was a well-known activist in the Black Panther Party, which was a radical political party in the United States in the late 60s and early 70s, and I had known her through some of the rallies where I had played, some work I had done with the Panthers. I had known her in New York, and now she had moved to Baltimore. I was living in Baltimore, and all of this was before I cut my hand. And so she was telling me that she had this son. He was 14. He was getting about to turn 15, and he fancied himself to be a poet, and he was experimenting with political poetry. He wanted to write about what was happening in the streets. He wanted to write about what was happening in the world. He wanted to write about life, and he wanted to put music to it, and he wasn't sure what direction to go. And she asked me if I would just talk to the kid and, you know, let him, is that my favorite term again, sponge. Let him sponge a little from me and see if we could, you know, have something in common. So she, you know, what the hell? I'll talk to anybody. So she brings this kid to me and before the coffee house opened one Saturday afternoon, and we hit it off. I mean, this kid, 14 years old, this kid had some poetry that, I mean, you listen to this stuff and it was like, oh my God, this kid's 48 years old and lives on the streets. I mean, he knows his shit. He knows life. And it was good. It was good, powerful stuff. And we connected on multiple levels with the music and with the poetry. And I guess probably for the next 9, 10, 11 months, he was more than a regular. He was he hung out. He came to all of our performances. He came to my open mic nights and performed. When the coffee house was closed, he'd hang out and talk. We'd have these in-depth political discussions. I'm going on and on about him because I was so enthralled with him, but I probably should get to the punchline, which is his name is Tupac Shakur. So, you know, you never know. But this was in his youth. This was, you know, he was 15 years old, and he was struggling with where he was going to go to high school. He was part of a busing program. And this idiotic busing program had him living where he did in the inner city there, had him being bused to this school called Roland Park, which was this upper class, snooty, I mean, it's a place where I couldn't even walk in the front door. It was where the super ruling class of Baltimore, and he was the token black kid there. And as we talked, we started talking about, you know, maybe you ought to go to Dunbar, which was the historically black high school there. And so we started working on how to get him into that. And then along the way came an opportunity to get instead to the Baltimore High School for the Arts. Because the other talent that he had, which I'm totally incompetent at, is dancing. And this kid could, he was a phenomenal ballet dancer. I mean, who knows that about Tupac, man? And I mean, he was incredible. And so he got into the Baltimore High School of the Arts as a actor dancer. And then after I cut my hand, I lost contact with the whole music community and with him and with his mom and all of those people as I went through my depressed funk until I came out of it. And by then they had left Baltimore and they were living in California, and people had started to know who he is.
If you're in Baltimore in that period, I've got to ask this. I always ask this of anybody who is from Baltimore, who has spent any time in Baltimore. Did you ever meet John Waters?
As a matter of fact, yes. I know. John Waters is.
I love that man.
John Waters is on the board of the Baltimore Museum of Art, or at least he was then. And anytime I would go to an opening at Baltimore Museum of Art, he would be there, of course. And during that era, you know, Divine was still alive then. And during that era, he was premiering his films, either all at the Charles Theater, which was near my coffee house, or at the Center Theater, which was near where I lived. So, I used to see him all the time. Were we like hangout buddies? And no. But did we know each other enough that he would go, oh, there's that crazy folk singer Gary. Oh, there's that crazy filmmaker John. Yeah, we knew each other on that level.
That's enough. Nodding acquaintance is fine by me. I love John Waters.
He's magical.
He really is. The world is a better place with him in it. And
you know what? I'm not surprised that you like him, because you have a lot of his personality. You have a lot of, oh, fuck it, let's do this kind of personality. And that is more than charming. That's terrific. That's brilliant. Yes. Ooh, yes.
Go me.
Yeah.
Right. I'm going to wrap it up there, Gary.
Cool.
Thank you so much. It's been, as ever, an education. Thank you.
Thank you. I've really enjoyed it.